On three continents, salmon farming in sea cages is endangering the ecosystem. In British Columbia on the west coast of Canada, sea lice, pollution, and escapes are endangering the last of the wild salmon runs. You are about to hear a speech from a salmon panel discussion, challenges, and possible action. This panel was organized by the Reverend Lois Boxhill of Christ Church Cathedral and held in that historic building in downtown Vancouver on April 27, 2010. Three of the four speakers were recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. They are available as free MP3 downloads from ecoshock.org on the Oceans page of the Audio On Demand menu. Here is Dr. William Rees, ecological economist, professor of ecology and resource planning, University of British Columbia, with an introduction by Lois Boxhill. Dr. Rees gives an overview on why industrial fishing is not sustainable.
Professor Rees is also the founding member and recent past president of the Canadian Society for Ecological Economics. He's a co-investigator in the Global Integrity Project, aimed at defining the ecological and political requirements for biodiversity preservation. He's a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and a founding fellow of the One Earth Initiative. So, without further ado, Professor Rees.
Thank you very much, Lois. I'm delighted that so many of you are out here tonight. It's a real honor, I think, for the panel that so many of you would be willing to sacrifice one of the first beautiful evenings of our spring to come and listen to a kind of a dismal series of presentations on the state of salmon in the province. Lois asked me if I would begin by putting you all asleep with a kind of an academic overview of the economics involved in the salmon industry in the province. And I want to start by pointing out to you that there are many possible economies, many possible ways of organizing society to do the things that we do under the name of economics. So the first point to take from this is that any economic system is what we would call a social construction. We make it up. And that means that it's based on a series of assumptions, pre-established beliefs, values, and so on and so forth. From my title, get some idea of what I think about our current economic system. We have an irrational, uneconomic approach to managing salmon, but it's all going forward under the rubric of sound economics. So that's really the theme that I'm going to be talking about tonight. First of all, we are all, in a sense, prisoners of a certain economic paradigm. You've all heard the term neoliberal economics or market economics. Sometimes neoclassical economics. And I've just listed here a number of the assumptions that are underneath this kind of economic thinking. First of all, there's a profound belief that human well-being is associated with income or your capacity to consume. And that means that we are literally defined in textbooks as self-interested utility maximizers with fixed preferences and insatiable material demands. So that's what we call homo economicus, the idea behind the way people are supposed to behave in the economy. Now, would you really want to invite that person to dinner, that self-interested utility maximizer with fixed preferences and insatiable material demands? No, but most of our economic behavioral models assume that that's what people are all about. Mainstream economic models make no connection whatsoever to anything outside of themselves. They do not include any consideration of moral or ethical things or social considerations, and they certainly make no reference whatsoever to the environment or to ecosystems. And so we have a system in which we assume the economy is essentially separate and independent of the environment. And so this is a diagram which you can see in many resource economics textbooks. And it starts out showing the economy and something called the environment as separate systems. Now, most of us think that makes sense because we're all trapped in a way of thinking of the environment as something out there that is separate and independent of the important stuff over here, the human economy. But the point I want to stress is that that is a social construction. There are societies today in which you can't talk this way. because there is no sense of separateness between the human enterprise or human beings and their environment. So we are, first of all, caught up in a construction of our minds that exists nowhere else but in our minds. This is not a representation of reality. Beyond that, then, and flowing out of that understanding, there are a number of other very important things to keep in mind. That resources are not important. You see, if there's no connection between the economy and nature, then we come up with such ideas as technological substitution. Increased factor productivity can substitute for resource depletion. And that means, again, to use the jargon term, manufactured capital, or things that humans produce, such as salmon farms, are a near-perfect substitute for wild salmon stocks. Why would you need the wild salmon if we can produce more salmon more abundantly and cheaper in a salmon farm? So we have, as a matter of economic rote, in many, many textbooks, statements such as this one, taken from one of the most famous texts in resource economics. Exhaustible resources do not pose a fundamental problem. See, again, if you start thinking the environment is essentially separate from nature, yes, there's a flow of resources, but humans can substitute technology for resources, then exhausting resources is a non-issue. And this is why our society is so cavalier about the depreciation and decline of so many of our natural assets. Now, just to show you I'm not making it up, that the bold quote here is from Robert Solow, a very prominent U.S. economist, a Nobel laureate who won his Nobel Prize for his work in showing how factor productivity, the increasing efficiency of resource use, enables us to carry on even as resources are declining. So look what Solow says. If it is easy to substitute other factors for natural resources, then in effect the world can get along without natural resources, and exhaustion is merely an event, not a catastrophe. So again, don't be too concerned when you hear about peak oil or declining fisheries or whatever that might be. And of course, this kind of academic thinking creeps into the popular literature. So here's a quote from a local journal, The Business Examiner, talking about BC salmon farms. Wild fish stocks, a major source of food for people throughout the world, are diminishing. Production of farm fish is an obvious replacement or substitution for wild fish and could therefore be stepped up significantly. So again, you see how these academic ideas, these social constructs, products of the human mind, creep into ordinary people's way of thinking about reality and determine how our culture acts out in the world. Another central point in modern economics is what I call the myth of efficiency. And we can say, I think, without any fear of doubt, the whole idea of globalization, for example, is based entirely on the idea of the efficiency gains to be made from the exploitation of something called comparative advantage in trade relationships. So the objective of economic analysis is to find ways to maximize. Look, if we're all self-interested utility maximizers, then we want to maximize production. And we can do that if we maximize efficiency. So we want to maximize the production of goods and services by the most efficient means possible and to ensure their efficient allocation through markets. And by definition, any government intervention in the market is inefficient because it interferes with the way in which people freely expend their incomes. And the problem with holding up a prime goal, efficiency, is that almost all other objectives of economic development are swept aside in the process. So we don't hear about ecological or social resilience. We don't plan to preserve biodiversity, social equity, community, or many other values that make life worthwhile. You are all victims of an economic model that places the efficiency of production and consumption above all other values. And we can see how our social fabric and certainly our ecological context is being degraded by this kind of belief set. So that's the kind of background from which I want to talk just briefly about the salmon farming industry. The numbers I'm using here are those of a PhD student of mine about a decade ago. So they may be a bit outdated, but I went online just today to see whether some of these numbers have changed much, and I find, and indeed they have not. What we're looking at here is a graph showing the return in terms of protein associated with the manufacture of salmon in salmon farms compared to the return generated by going fishing. So that if we look at the amount of energy expended in producing a fish compared to the energy contained in the valuable protein in the fish produced, you can form a ratio which is called the energy return on investment. And what you see right off the top is that the protein return on energy investment of farmed Atlantic and farmed Chinook salmon is less than 3%. Now, it's frankly not that much better in the fished or the wild stocks in the sense that it's only 6.7% up to 11%. But the point is that those stocks are 3 and 4 times more efficient than growing fish in farms, all things in. So what we did in this study was study a fleet of salmon fishers who go out to sea chasing salmon, and we had every input of energy and material in the course of a couple of seasons of their work and compared that to exactly the same kinds of data for the fish farms, and these are the kinds of numbers that are revealed. So there's flaws in this efficiency ointment, you know, fly in the ointment. Okay, why are we not efficient? Because by definition, efficiency requires that we can identify all of the benefits and all the costs associated with any particular production activity. Right? If you can't identify the costs and the benefits, then you don't know your benefit-cost ratio. So the objective of efficiency not only is to have more benefits than costs, but to maximize the difference between the two. The problem is that it's very easy to identify and monetize or describe in money terms the benefits of any activity because there's a market price, right? So if you want to ask someone, what does farm salmon cost in the marketplace? What's the gain to the economy from the sale of salmon? It's easy to go down and check it out. But if you ask, well, what's the dollar value of the cost? We haven't a clue. What is the dollar value of the pollution that occurs under each of these farms? What is the dollar cost that's going to be associated with what seems to have happened in just the last few months? Certain of the sea lice that infest salmon seem to have evolved immunity to the main chemical control of those sea lice. Well, what's the cost of that? We haven't any clue. And so most of the costs associated with any particular economic activity are not only hard to identify, but they're virtually impossible to put a dollar value on. So we have a situation in which the requirement of meeting your efficiency criterion requires that you know the costs and benefits in total and that you can maximize the difference between the two. That's your maximal or optimal economy. But when all you can measure are the positive money benefits in the economy, and we can't put a price on the costs, we're lost. So here we are deluded into thinking we're operating an efficient economy when in fact most of the important information is not there. Efficiency then is really a mythic goal impossible to attain. And we're delusional if we think otherwise. So we continue to promote growth and may actually have already reached a stage, and this is really important. If you have reached a stage in your economic development or growth where the hidden costs, which you are not measuring, exceed the benefits, which you can measure, then you're no longer engaged in economic growth, it's uneconomic growth. It's costing you more than you're gaining, but because you don't even know about those costs, you're not aware of this until it's too late to do anything about it. And I'm arguing that globally we've reached that stage right now. This is what this looks like in a simple mathematical terms. The top curve represents the gains from an economy that's growing. So it steadily grows, and early on in the development, each gain is a little more important than those that come later. If you think of a new territory being opened up, the first sawmill, for example, is always more important than the 30th sawmill. So you see a gradual decline in what we call the marginal benefits of development. But the total benefits continue to rise. So the top line in this curve is the total benefits from economic development, and you can see it's steadily rising. The bottom line is a measure of the total costs associated with that development. Now, initially they're low, basically just the capital costs of putting the first sawmill in place, for example. But as development proceeds, there starts to be damage to the water supply. You're creating a flood hazard by clear cutting. You may be harming a wildlife habitat. The tourism industry takes a hit. You damage the salmon. All of those things start mounting up. And so you can see the total costs of development rise quite quickly. Now, there is a point at which the total benefits and total costs are maximally different, and that's point A on the bottom axis. So as you develop, there will be an optimal scale of the economy. For all points to the left of point A, the gains from growth exceed the costs. But for all points to the right of point A on the axis, every time you grow, the costs are increasing faster than the benefits. But if you're not measuring the costs, and you're only measuring those rising benefits, you're inclined to continue growing, even though you're impoverishing yourself by reducing costs faster than gains. This is a ridiculous situation, and yet it's precisely the situation we find ourselves in today in many sectors of our economy. The problem is that those who are benefiting, all of the benefits tend to go to the moneyed interests who have big investments, and all the costs tend to be imposed on the relatively powerless people and the poor people in society, those who suffer the loss of the salmon fishery or the water quality or whatever it might be. And you can extrapolate this globally, and we know very well that in the world today, the benefits of global growth are almost entirely accruing to the rich people who already have it, and almost none of those gains in absolute terms are going to the very poor. So if we look at salmon in this kind of framing, we know that the feed pellets are made, even now, about 50% of fish meal. Now these are perfectly good fish caught somewhere else on the planet and then converted into fish feed to feed salmon, but at a huge thermodynamic loss. So that the bottom line here is that it takes about 4 to 5 kilograms of other species of fish to produce 1 kilogram of farmed salmon. How efficient is that when you think that many of the fish going into the production of the feed are perfectly edible and indeed used to show up in the fish markets of South America, for example? If we look at the energy costs, I've already shown you a graph about that. I go to the bottom line. In the case of farm Chinook, which is the least efficient of all, 5 liters of diesel fuel equivalent are embodied in each kilogram of fillets produced. That's an enormous energy and carbon cost associated with producing these fish. This is the edible protein returns from a number of different industrial production processes. So look at here. We see that the more industrially inclined we are in our food production processes, the less efficient we are in terms of producing protein. And you'll notice that farmed salmon are right up there with the livestock, stockyard beef, and so on and so forth. Okay? If we look at the ecological footprint, Lois mentioned that some of my work has been in this domain. Your ecological footprint is simply the area of productive ecosystems needed to produce everything you consume and to assimilate your wastes. Well, we can do the same thing for an industry. How much of the Earth's surface is dedicated to producing the resources that that industry uses and to assimilate its wastes? And when we do that for the various farming attributes of farm salmon and wild stocks, again we see that the eco-footprints, the ecological demands of farm salmon per kilogram are vastly larger than those of the wild fish, which are indicated here in red. So we have a situation where we find that with the current global fish catch, about a third of it, a little more than a third, is converted to animal feed. So fish that could be used to feed people are converted to chicken feed, calf starter, and of course salmon pellets. This means that with the high demand in the global marketplace, globalization becomes a means by which the wealthy appropriate the real wealth of poor people. In that high-priced marketplace, Peruvian fish processors couldn't even afford to purchase fish in their own markets. So dozens of fish canning plants were shut down. And it got to the point where the Peruvian government, early on in this decade, had to go against the WTO rules and hold back fish so that these fish could be processed locally for local consumption. So again, globalization enables those with the money to purchase the wealth of other people, the material and biological wealth, and convert it into a smaller quantity of higher grade protein in, for example, the salmon farming industry. But I don't want to just finger them. It's chicken feed, pig feed, and cattle starter, and all of the rest of it. There's real inequity here. So the question that I want to raise in this context is a very simple one. Is it morally, ethically acceptable for wealthy people to extend their ecological footprints into the developing world to produce luxury goods if it compromises poorer local populations' ability to satisfy their basic needs? And this is the question that we as a culture have got to begin to look seriously at, because the simple fact of the matter is that the world population is growing, incomes are rising, per capita consumption is going up much more rapidly than population, and the Earth simply cannot sustain the levels of consumption that we enjoy in any kind of a sustainable manner. So my basic conclusion is that net pen salmon farming is just one of many examples that springs from the kind of economy we have created in our heads but then replicate in the real world that is unsustainable by any stretch of the imagination, morally, ethically, ecologically, and frankly, even economically. If we could identify and monetize the costs associated with it, it would turn out to be non-economic. This is what we should be thinking. Instead of the economy as a separate system, the human enterprise is a fully embedded, completely dependent subsystem of the ecosphere. And yet, because we don't recognize that in our heads, we've put ourselves in the position of being a consuming society that is growing within the ecosphere. We are literally like a maggot in an apple, consuming the planet from within. And we're all going to be suffering the consequences of this in the longer term if we don't start paying attention. So, that's a different way of looking at reality, but it would lead to very different ways of approaching economic development. And I just wanted to end by these two quotes showing that it really matters how you think about things. Everything we think about is a social construction, but some social constructions are better than others. And we've created an economic paradigm that is destroying the planet and undercutting societies around the Earth. We need to shift to a different kind of social construct that will support both human communities and the ecosystems upon which they depend. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill. So we now have our first 5-minute clarifying questions for Professor Rees. Does anyone have a razor-sharp question? The mic's down there.
It's so utterly clear, I guess there's nothing that needs to be debated. Yeah.
Now, Professor Rees, it's a compelling case you've made. But if you're a simple fish farmer, fisher somewhere, and if you're taking into account all the real costs, and you're competing with somebody who is not, then you're on the short end of that competition. And although it may be true in the long run that your competition is going to go under because they're not meeting all the real costs of their operation, one's life turns on much more short-term calculations. Okay. So how does one get around this?
So the question is, if we're in a competitive economy and you're trying to do the right thing, which would obviously raise your costs of production and therefore the costs of your product, you can't compete against someone else who's taking the shortcuts and, in fact, basically acting the way I've suggested most of it. In that circumstance, that is the global circumstance in which we find ourselves. The real costs of most goods and services in the market today do not reflect the true costs of production. When you bring in a computer for $500 made in China, it leaves behind, I don't know, but I would guess 2 or 3 times that in pollution damage costs that are not associated or connected to the price of the good you're purchasing. We have consciously made a decision to offload our dirty industries onto the Chinese. And we don't impose a tariff at the border that would raise the price of those imported goods to reflect their true costs of production. So in effect, we're willing to enable the entire global economy to operate at the bottom end. It's this rush to the ecological bottom. And you can thank that kind of competitive circumstance for the cheap goods and services that we pick up in the marketplace today. But just about everything we purchase is being purchased at great ecological and health costs to the world at large. And if climate change begins to accelerate, that'll be the single greatest, what we refer to as ecological externality, that we've ever imposed on ourselves. So it's a beautiful question. And recognize that whether you're conscious of it or not, we're all participating in this game willingly, because we object to higher taxes that would then be able to reflect, say, a carbon tax would raise the price of goods to their true cost of production. Best thing that could happen to us in many respects. Haven't got time to get into the details, but that's the truth.
Okay, how do we switch from what we have now to an ecological economic system?
I teach two courses on that subject. So it's first of all, we have to raise to consciousness that we're in a situation more or less as I've described tonight. And there's huge vested interests out there resisting almost everything that I've suggested. So if you think of the climate denial campaigns, the campaigns of the financial sector, the financial sector has spent in the last 10 years $5 billion in New York and in Washington lobbying policymakers to bring about in ways that led to the financial crash of a couple of years ago. So the question is a very good one. How do we change? Again, this is a social construction. We are all part of this. And we have all been hoodwinked by a massive campaign in the last 40 years to move us from thinking of community, of sharing, of the kinds of programs we used to come up with in Canada. Remember the good old days of Medicare and unemployment insurance and so on and so forth. Things that made for a better society. We've lost all of that, and we now think of first, number one, right? We've become selfish, competitive, less and less oriented toward community, and we've lost so much because of the purposeful construction by the right wing through think tanks such as the Fraser Institute right here in Vancouver that have poisoned people against thinking that we are even a society. Margaret Thatcher once said, there's no such thing as society. She made that as a throwaway line, but it sort of epitomizes what's happened. So the answer to your question is political engagement, insistence in meetings such as this, that we begin to see the truth, that we recognize that the path that we're on for what it is, and that we have to engage politically to change it around. Otherwise, we're just going to carry on the way we are.
You have just heard Dr. William Reese, Professor of Ecology and Resource Planning at the University of British Columbia. He is the co-inventor of the ecological footprint. Dr. Reese spoke at the Salmon Panel discussion, Challenges and Possible Action. This panel was organized by the Reverend Lois Boxhill of Christ Church Cathedral and held in that historic building in downtown Vancouver. Three of the four speakers were recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. They are available as free MP3 downloads from ecoshock.org on the Oceans page of our Audio On Demand menu.